Well, I too would like to thank the organisation for involving me in this extraordinary inauguration in this wonderful building. Asked to speak in the art and text section, I wanted to find a topic where Greek art and text are equally at home, and one which offers a chance also of seeing them combined in performance, arguably the dominant Byzantine cultural concern, albeit in a society without a drama. So I left aside Ekphrasis, which is really about an eternal textual miracle whereby language achieves what W.J.T. Mitchell once described as impossible, the bringing of things vividly before the eyes. I also left aside the Aegesis narrative, which we've considered this morning and I have worked on elsewhere. I chose representation, mimesis. As for what should be represented, I cast my net as wide as possible in terms of Byzantium as a whole. This has the advantage of addressing the idea of Byzantine reflexivity. Remember, we talked about it yesterday. It may give us a new answer. I see representation as a fundamentally human activity, and rather than as a cultural process reflecting a pre-existent reality, as a practice which produces culture in a society as interactive, ideologically edgy, constituted by and for society. And I adopted Stuart Hall's representation diagram. I do like diagrams. Rather than Mitchell's, which is a simple one, or even Odorico's. And so back to Hall's for now. I looked for panoramic and panoptic texts and images and performances. What I found was three texts of the 7th, 8th, or 9th and 12th centuries, and a single image found both inside and very close to the empire. What I found was not the favourite or iconic texts, the Hymns of Romanos, perhaps, or the History of Anna Komnene, or the most brilliant of the experimental fiction of the 12th century, any of which would have been a much better choice if I simply wanted to showcase the achievements of Byzantine culture. Nor did I find the texts that the Byzantines themselves would have wanted to showcase. The polemics that Avril Cameron works on, for example, or the rich homiletic literature that Niki Tsironis has made her own. Or the prolific and fantastically textured rhetoric of the 11th and 12th centuries. All these are major achievements also. What I found was texts which hardly count as literature, either in the modern canon or in Byzantium. I found one frame story with included monastic folklore, but you could argue that it's a predecessor to Boccaccio's plague stories and Chaucer's tales, John Moschus's Jerusalem-based spiritual meadow. Secondly, an Eastern text so useful that it was an essential handbook for the emperor to take on campaign in the 10th century, Achmet's Onirokritikon. And finally, the one with most literary pretensions, a Lucianic satire, which takes us and its Cappadocian hero to Thessaloniki and then down to Hades, and that's the Timarion. Of the same level of panopticity, I found only 11th to 12th century representations of the Last Judgment, and here look at the second register up on the left. But this wasn't where I started. I looked at representations of the individual. I found a huge range in literature, as I could perhaps have learnt simply from Hinterberger's book, with letters which are described as the icon of the soul, with saints' lives and authors intruding into histories, and iconismi and ekphrasis of individuals. In art, of course, I found the icon and, from time to time, a separate understanding of what a portrait might be that was not an icon. There's a great 11th century case of this. Performativity of individuals has been elucidated recently by Stratis Papiouannou and Derek Kruger. Ceremony often focused on the individual, whether installation of an abbot or baptism of a catechumen. What we're dealing with is ascribed identities, and they may be found by exclusion and by assimilation. There is regulation also, remember the diagram, as in the origin of the iconismi, and unexpected levels of style for saints' lives. I looked at dyads and I found them also in words, images, and performance. Husband-wife relations appear in hagiography and legal material, father-son relations in parenesis, advice from an imperial or aristocratic father to his son, brother-brother relations in 11th century Thrini, spiritual kinship in the letters of spiritual parents to their children, and images of well-known couples sometimes indicate the nature of the relationship, Joseph and Mary, Ruth and Boaz, Abraham and Sarah, Joseph and Potiphar's wife. They sometimes show how different are our concerns from those of the Byzantines. Two eternal triangles in the 9th and in the 11th century, when represented in the Madrid Scilices, emphasize taxis rather than the sexual relationship. So Ingerina and Zoe, the imperial women, are all up in the box. It's their status that matters. Other images present puzzles. Are the images built on the visitation model, examples of friendship, or symbols of political alliance, long away from their origin? In performance, marriage and Adelphopoeia rituals signify the importance of these relations to society and also regulate them. But can we always read what they are telling us? Social groups in art include monastic group portraits, and here's two monks and then the nuns of the Vivere Elpis. And family portraits are like a family snapshot, or in the case of the Lincoln College Typikon, a family album. Or they break down what we might begin to think of again as a court scene, after a very long time not thinking of it as a court scene, into its constituent parts, army, senate, church. Texts tend to offer social milieu rather than groups. The peasants of the free peasants of the villages in the life of Philaretos, the frontier society of Dionys. In terms of performance, both liturgy and ceremony demanded the splitting of the performing group with antiphonal choirs for church, the blues and greens in hippodrome entertainment. The ceremony of dining depended on the great imperial virtue of taxis, making sure that bishops and generals were seated in the right order. Identity and regulation are both at play here too. But only the three key texts and the image of the Last Judgment offer an overview of Byzantine society. The texts were not at all concerned, of course, with doing that. Moschus was concentrating on the glories of monasticism in the past, rather than the rich human cast of his storytelling. Achmet was a practical handbook to tell you the future of dreams. Timarion is a narrower panorama, but has the wonderful ability to telescope time that an icon like the Icon of Orthodoxy in the British Museum possesses. And the Timarion brings hotshot 12th century intellectuals up against a moaning Romanos the Oienis after the Battle of Masticurt, Leo VI and his eunuch angel, and any number of philosophers from antiquity. Regulation, identity, are served through the expectation of imitation of good example, the handbook function of the Oneida Criticon and satire. The image of the Last Judgment, seen in an 11th century manuscript, we've seen it already in a wall painting at Torcello, you can see the same groups of individuals, of classes of person, the emperors, the women, the bishops, the monks. It's explained in various texts as having a bearing on life. The comparison between the heavenly court comes up again and again in texts. Alexius I Komnenos was obsessed with an image of the Last Judgment in his palace, drawing the lessons on judgment in this world and the next. And in Scilicis, there is a story about a Bulgar Tsar who commissioned paintings on his wall, supposedly of his awesome feats at arms, but the artist, when told to choose the most terrifying, selected the Last Judgment instead. All these texts serve one or more of the following functions in Byzantium: subversion, reinforcement, propaganda. And these can be seen most clearly in performance, when we can see the first function of culture, showing Byzantium at its best to visiting ambassadors, mercenaries and merchants, again with reference to another world. Rhetoric, music, liturgy, processions, icons, great public buildings were all used to represent a society with distinct reminiscences of heaven, as the emissaries of the Russians duly noted. We cannot forget that beauty. So Byzantium represented itself and was represented from outside through its texts and images and performances as a complex society with a strong state, a very clear view of its role in the world. Some of this you will have to take on trust or actually look at the online version. But with robust and multiplex personal relations, which form powerful networks of influence, and with subgroups and communities with strong identities. It had a respect for taxes and for the yenos, but it was, from time to time, meritocratic and open to social advancement, discouraging trade, but developing both a local gentry and an urban middle class. And what's noticeable is that the clearest views of society as a whole are achieved when the focus is ostensibly on something different. In Moschus, the attention was on the journey within the monastic world of the Mediterranean, divided as it was between Miaphysite and Orthodox. Yet the monastic storytellers, who take on the role within the frame story of the journey, spread their nets wide beyond the monastery gate. The desert and the city were opposed societies in this worldview, seen at its best in the surreal Sinai stories, and we see the city through the haze of the desert. In Ahmed, the different level of perception, which becomes a different level of discourse and narrative, finds its exegesis in this handbook. We may see an everyday world at which every night can transform itself into signals for the future. We think of dreams as being about the past, but Byzantines were clear they were about the future. But that concentration on the future allows us to see the Byzantine present as viewed by Ahmet's readership if we can only crack the codes and learn to interpret the genre. In Timarion, past and future come together in the eschatology of satire. Byzantine society was best and most visibly represented through the prism of an alternative existence, the world of monastic renunciation, the world of apocalyptic and satire, and the topsy-turvy world of dream, where everyday logic is overturned, but everyday reality is sharply observed and transformed into a newly constructed Byzantium. But what has the exercise told us about art and text in Byzantium? Do words describe and images show? Surely not just that, as Leslie said. We've seen that subversion is not restricted to images. We are clear that words were not received only by the rhetoric. Moschus's was a folkloric compilation of monastic storytelling. Memory, even if a subversive memory in Timarion, and not at all, or necessarily so in hagiography, was an important function of words as well as of images. In such a performative culture, levels of literacy were important, but not exclusive. Many texts could be received at some level by listeners, performers, and even readers who were not capable of reading at the highest levels. Some who heard the Moschus stories would be unaware of the vast travel and geographical literature in Greek, which attempted to control geodata from Herodotus and Pausanias through Procopius and on. The users of Ahmed would not necessarily know about the earlier Greek and neocritical literature, nor care about the continuous practice of incubation in temple and cult site. Receivers of Timarion might appreciate the satire of figures in recent political history without picking up parody of contemporary rhetoric or lampooning of current intellectual society. All the texts have a Greek pedigree in some way, yet none of them makes pretentious claims to high culture. They handle the past, present, and future in a way which makes a continuity not impossible without actually requiring it. But texts and images don't work in the same way. Images perhaps might work best in dialogue, when, as in some manuscripts, the scribe is also the painter, sometimes even the patron. Performance is best at propaganda, of the most culturally seductive kind. Texts can say the unsayable, through use of genre and other conventions, so can images, of course. And even if sometimes words can gain meaning from images, sometimes they can be symbiotic but complementary. Sometimes they're static when the texts are dynamic. Sometimes texts are plain necessary to explain an image you simply couldn't have followed it without. Sometimes the images can simply not be there when you expect them, and my example there is of muses. We've seen that images are good at telescoping time, offering a key snapshot of narrative, or appearing to, but actually combining several stages in one. The panoptic vision is not at all easy to find in Byzantine art. For example, we don't have the great court and ceremony images as we do by Bellini for Venice or of Orange or Habsburg courts. And there's no overview of monastic life like Moschus's until late medieval icons of the death of ascetics, which lead into the Thebaid scenes of the early Renaissance. There are even fewer scenes of Byzantine dreaming, and this is the only one I know of a Nero criticism. I'd be delighted to receive more. And I think no Höllenfahrt image, just because this one is so pervasive and prevalent. So what you might say is wrong with logocentricity. I am a text person. W.J.T. Mitchell's picture theory begins with the idea that the linguistic turn has been replaced with a pictorial turn. But that is also a literary scholar who's speaking, who with another literary scholar, Norman Bryson, has been responsible for a great deal of what current art historical theory is not dependent on French literary theory. We could say that St. Basil was using a vivid image. The theorists of the period of iconoclasm were justifying icons because they needed to. Words can be just as good as images and just as memorable as at other periods of Greek, especially when the multisensual environment of mimesis in the other sense of performance kicks in. We knew not whether we were in heaven or on earth.